Hello, I'm Paul Vandekar, and this is Inside Stories, a podcast about all things storytelling. On this episode, I speak with Taylor Krause, who runs Voices of Rwanda, an organization dedicated to recording and preserving testimonies of survivors of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. I asked Taylor how he got started with the project.
I first traveled to Rwanda in 2004 to work on a short film. And while I was in Rwanda, I was interviewing all different kinds of people, from radio journalists who had been working for RTLM to survivors of the genocide. And I thought I was going to make a 20-minute film, come back home to the United States, and continue on working on other film projects. But for the year that followed my return to the U.S., for the rest of 2004 and into 2005, I realized that I needed to go back to Rwanda, that I didn't feel comfortable simply moving on, simply jumping onto a new film project. And part of that was because I didn't know what could be accomplished by producing the short film that I had planned on doing. I didn't think that an audience would do what I wanted to happen. I wasn't quite sure what I thought should happen, but I thought if I'm unwilling to take the time to do what I think needs to happen, then how do I expect an audience to do so? So I really, thought about what could I contribute. And trained as a documentary filmmaker, I felt that perhaps I could contribute to a process of documenting testimonies because that wasn't happening.
And so tell me, just to back up a second, so there's all this money going into Rwanda to rebuild, but very little of it to help survivors of the genocide share their stories. It seems like such a natural. I mean, it's surprising that wasn't happening more. But what other kinds of forums were there, however limited? Were there, I think, the community courts or something like that?
I should even specify that it's not that the aid wasn't existing for survivors to share their stories. Aid wasn't earmarked for survivors in general. A survivor community, which is just a few hundred thousand in a country of 10 million. So it wasn't even simply that survivors didn't have a place to speak. It was also that survivors weren't being taken care of. There were a few outlets, potentially, for survivors to be able to share their stories. But these were largely focused on punitive justice. You have, of course, the International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda in Arusha, Tanzania, and you have the local tribunal system in Rwanda, the Gacaca court system. But both of these systems are focused on punitive justice and actually focused more on the perpetrators than on the survivors, and actually also not necessarily a good environment whereby survivors can share their stories publicly or even would want to share their stories publicly. So we felt like perhaps we could fulfill that need for people to share and fill a void in the justice system, a void in society. Of course, you have a society where survivors live next to the killers of their own families, and so there's very little space to speak about the past. Even amongst survivors themselves, sometimes it's incredibly difficult for them to share each other's stories with each other. So that's what we do. We're listening to these stories, these life stories of survivors, and eventually bringing these stories to students around the world, as well as building an archive so that they can exist for future generations in Rwanda.
I mean, I'm curious, so you're a white American guy. How do they feel talking with you? I mean, is it do they easily take you on as kind of an outsider, a dispassionate outsider, or what's that relationship like?
When I first thought that this process needed to happen, I didn't know if I or the team of outsiders was the right team to be doing this project. I didn't know if we build Voices of Rwanda, is this something that we should be doing as outsiders? I went around the country at least up the eastern seaboard in the United States, meeting with Tutsi survivors. And they all assured me that this process needed to happen. And of course, there was a realization of the practicality of it, that certainly funds would have to come from the outside. But there was also, I think, a need to express these stories to the outside. So first, by being an outsider, I represent the outside world in some way, and those who conduct the testimonies, represent the outside world, finally coming to the table to listen. And I think secondarily, it's really important that we are outsiders, both to be honest about who is going to be listening to these stories, but also because even within Rwanda, you have social dynamics that are very complicated. And so being an outsider actually allows for a certain kind of trust to be built. If you want to break it down, of course, you can imagine that if a Hutu perpetrator or if a Hutu attempts to interview a Tutsi survivor, there may be issues of trust. And the same goes as well as if you are a Tutsi born in Uganda or a Tutsi born in Congo, there might not be the same kind of trust within the community. And these are things that I didn't even recognize at the time, but eventually realized that being an outsider actually helped the process.
Tell me more about what you hope to have happen specifically with these interviews.
One of the most special experiences I've ever had doing this work, well, it happened on April 8th, 2011. I was in Ottawa, Canada, and I was presenting testimonies to a large community of Rwandans there. The community of Rwandans in Canada is very large, and in Ottawa and Quebec, of course, because of Francophonie and also because the community has kind of gathered momentum, it's growing. And I sat in a room of between 200 and 300 individuals, many of whom were survivors, and screened testimonies. And at the end of the screening, a man stood up and said, "That woman that was just on the video, I grew up with her. Her brother, who was killed in the genocide, was my best friend. He was my best man in my wedding." And he went on to talk about her family and her life. I was reminded in my own mind how this history had really torn apart the country and thrust so many individuals into the diaspora and really spread apart a community, but that somehow the survivor community was so connected by their historical experience and that they were one community. And this was this really profound moment of recognition that these testimonies, even if these testimonies were never heard by anybody outside of the survivor community, they are still critical and they are still so important that the survivor community, and he went on to talk about how he asked his fellow survivors, he says, "Please share. This is so important. Even we don't talk to each other." And so it was through the process of listening to these testimonies and seeing that other people had been so generous and trusting to share that he was trying to get his own community to open up to each other. That was a very profound and special experience for me because I realized that just simply a camera and sitting down and giving somebody time and listening to them can have a profound impact on the community itself. These testimonies will be used in schools or for research. Unfortunately, there seems to be, partly in this YouTube era, there seems to be an abuse of narrative almost. And we hope that somehow in filming full life stories, that people come to the table and listen in a very different way than by simply listening to stories of atrocity. So we hope that we can be the guardians of these testimonies in a way that the survivors want their stories to be heard. And the only way to know that we're doing the right thing is by maintaining relationships with these individuals.
Can you tell me a story or two from the interviews? I mean, obviously it'd have to be in capsule form, but any particularly moving interviews for you?
One of my favorite moments was when a woman began singing about a Rwandan proverb, and she was singing this song about Kajemba Jemba, Kajemba Jemba, and she was singing this song in Kinyarwanda, and it was this amazingly beautiful song about Kajemba Jemba, and then when it was fully translated, I fully began to understand that this was a story about a child whose parents, whose mother had died, and then the father remarried a mother, and in Rwanda there's a strange relationship between stepmothers and the children, and the mother wanted to, you know, seek out this Kajemba Jemba and kept searching for Kajemba Jemba. He would run away, and then he would come back, and Eventually, she was trying to cook a stew with this child. I mean, it was a very dark, sort of Grimm's fairy tale kind of story, and it revealed to me some of the really complicated underlayers of fairy tales and proverbs in Rwandan culture, even stories about Rwanda before money. You know, before they had money, and what they, or parts of Kigali that used to be forested and jungle, and there, you know, there used to be lions here, and people telling stories, old people talking about what this city used to look like. Those are always very special elements to the story. And of course, you have the darkest elements of the story that you can imagine from having, you know, heard about Rwanda and heard about the horrific nature of the way the genocide was perpetrated by individuals with machetes and clubs. But I think some of the most poignant moments also come from understanding the relationships between the people who are sharing their testimonies and those whom they have lost. And one of the most special moments for me was when a man started talking about having found the remains of his father and having spent the night in the same room with the bones of his father after having washed them and prepared them for burial, and he even had to break them to fit them in the small box. But the story, the way he told it, it wasn't a gruesome story. It was a story of tenderness, and it was a story of being with his father. And so I think when we listen to some of these stories, if you approach it so, you know, openly, then you allow them to actually resonate with you in ways that you can't even imagine.
What are kind of the burning questions in your mind right now about this work? Could be a technological question or an ethical question or a procedural or what have you.
I'm always very curious as to how the rest of the world sees this kind of work, because it seems like there are always different interests asking for justification of the work. And I feel like after having done this work for now as an organization, a five-year-old organization, we recognize that the work is an end in itself, that it's not a means to advocacy. It's not a means to prevention. Certainly, testimonies can be used in different ways, but that it's an end in itself. And I'm curious as to why people feel the need to justify the process of listening, a very human process, a process of engaging as an international community, of finally saying, we recognize our guilt in this process, and we're coming to the table and saying, we want to listen, and we recognize that we've done you harm and your family's harm.
What are some questions that people ask you, whether it's survivors or students or other people you come in contact with?
I think sometimes survivors are puzzled as to why there are people that are finally coming to listen. And they're puzzled, you know, why are you here? Whether it's myself or other people who are conducting the testimonies. And they want to know why this matters. I mean, many times when I'm there, why are you here? And I explain why I think I'm there. And I explain, and they keep asking the question. And sometimes they just want to understand that I'm there for my own personal reasons. And my own personal reasons for me also comes to the fact that I feel like I inherited history, you know, a Jewish narrative in some regards, and that it's my obligation, having inherited that history, having seen how the Jewish community dealt with its own memory, that I also have an obligation to go out and listen to survivors as a Jew, as an international, you know, citizen, as a human being. And so I think they want to know before that they share anything why I'm personally invested in this. And I think that's really important, to be open and to have a conversation and it not to be a faceless organization. I mean, people ask all kinds of questions, how testimonies, you know, impact me. And the fact is they've changed me in ways that I'm not so happy about. But at a certain point in my life, I chose to move forward with my eyes open. And I think in this world that has consequences, recognizing the complications and the consequences of our own civilization.
That was Taylor Krause, director of Voices of Rwanda. To learn more about the organization, please visit the Inside Stories website at www.insidestoriesonline.com. I'm Paul Vandekar. Thanks for listening.